che è professore all'Università di Austin, che è l'Università Pubblica del Texas, ed è uno dei maggiori esperti di questioni legate alle diseguaglianze, ed è autore di questo libro che si chiama Inequality and Instability, uscito 6 mesi fa, che collega in un modo molto innovativo la questione, la misura delle diseguaglianze tradizionali legate agli aspetti economici e salariali con le dinamiche macroeconomiche, i cicli e i fattori di crisi. Abbiamo una sua presentazione che durerà una mezz'oretta e avremo modo poi di entrare anche nel merito di alcuni aspetti legati alla misura e all'analisi delle diseguaglianze, al rapporto tra crisi e diseguaglianze e alle implicazioni di politica economica per la crisi attuale. James?
Well, thank you very much, Professor Pianta, and it's a true pleasure to be here and to have a chance to talk with a group, many of whom I understand are working on problems quite similar to those which have interested and motivated me and my PhD students over many years now. And what I thought I would do this afternoon, and please make a sign if I'm speaking too rapidly or not audible to the people in the back. But what I thought I would do here this afternoon is to give you a kind of tour d'horizon, a broad overview of of the research that I have been engaged in this area, research which has recently been summarized in what is now the third book to emerge from broadly from this product, this project, and there are now quite a large number also of working papers and journal articles which have been also appeared in the similar vein. Let's see, can figure out which of these is the right thing. The project has gone by the name of the University of Texas Inequality Project, and it's been in existence for 16 years or so. And it has been, throughout that time, largely concerned with an apparently simple problem, which is which is the difficulty of making accurate, reliable, and informative measurements and comparisons of economic inequality between countries and over time. And those of you who work in this area, I think, are aware that the principal source of raw material in the field, which is surveys by and large of income or even tax records, suffers from two major drawbacks or deficiencies. The first one being that, as between countries, surveys are often conceptually different. That is to say, they are focused on concepts which are not easily comparable across countries. You can have surveys of income, you can have surveys of expenditure, you can have surveys that are focused on the household, surveys that are focused on the individual. You can have surveys that do or do not include various types of income as income, surveys which are limited to cities, surveys which extend to the countryside. That's a first problem, and it raises a question about the comparability of the resulting measures of inequality. And the second problem is that surveys are expensive. And being expensive, they are often not carried out on a consistent and regular basis. And so that for many countries in the world, one finds that you may have a good survey, but you may only have two or three of them over a 50-year period, particularly in the developing world. And this means that it's very hard to know how a measure of economic inequality actually evolved over time. You have to make heroic extrapolation in order to have an idea, and your extrapolation is just as likely to be wrong as right. What we did was to seek out alternative ways of, alternative sources of information that could provide instruments for the missing and non-comparable data and enable us to construct data sets that were relatively dense and relatively complete. And you can do this in two ways. You can do this on the basis of international comparative data sets, of which there are a good number. The one that we used most extensively in our work actually is based upon the industrial statistics of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO. But there are also statistics from the OECD, something called the Structural Analysis Database that we've used, statistics from Eurostat, and other internationally comparable data sources. And then the second way is to use national data sources, which provide you with a particularly rich and detailed historical portrait of individual countries, but not necessarily on a basis which can be so easily compared between countries. As I said earlier, we now have quite a lot of material, and it's all available online at this website with 16 working papers and about 15 data sets, which are readily downloadable, and you can look at them yourself if you're interested. What ties the project together is a common mathematical approach. And all the mathematics of the entire project are summarized on that slide. So it's an exceptionally simple structure to the data sources. What we are using are data that are organized into groups. We do not have micro-level survey data. That's the problem, that we don't have a systematic world full of intercomparable micro-level surveys conducted on a regular basis. But what we do have in the world is a lot of administrative data which presents information by, let's say, economic categories of a roughly comparable type, usually industrial categories. That is to say, and there are internationally comparable industrial classification schemes that you can use for this purpose. Also, let's say economic sectors, which are broader than industries and allow you to have information outside of manufacturing, covering services and agriculture as well. Also, perhaps most comprehensively, information by geographic subdivision, by province within country, by county within province, by municipality within province, by, in Europe, the NUTS level regional classification schemes. And all you need to have for any classification scheme is information about the population of the group, which is the P there, the share of each group in total, in the total population, and the relative income of that group, that is to say, the average income of the group compared to the average income of the whole population, which is the R sub J, mu sub J over mu. And when you have those two pieces of information, which is to say, all you really need in order to compute this is a group structure with an income, a total income and a population, that's it, then you can compute a between groups component of tiles T statistic. And tiles T statistic is decomposable. If you had the within group component, that would be the expression for it, but you actually don't have that. You could take the within group component, weight it by the income of the group, and sum it, and you get the weighted sum of the within group components. You don't have that either. What you do have, excuse me, what you got is this. You have the between groups component of a tiles t-statistic. Exceptionally simple to compute. And the proposition that I would offer for you is that between groups component for a sufficiently detailed group structure is a very good instrument for the whole thing. It travels in time almost exactly parallel to the larger unobserved measure of inequality, and very closely parallel to measures of inequality computed from other data sources, such as sample surveys, if you happen to have good ones, or census measures, or tax measures, if you happen to have good ones of those. The advantage of our approach is a much broader, more systematic coverage through time. So this, if you just take one of the data sets that we developed, is the coverage of the UTIP UNITO inequality data set. In terms of numbers of observations by, each observation is a country in a given year, across the major regions of the world and the decades from the 60s to the 2000s. And you can see that for the densest period, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we have over 900 observations in each decade. And for the overall data set, we have almost 3,500 country year observations. And if you compare that to a major data set, which was used very extensively for economic analysis in this area, the so-called high-quality version of the Dininger and Squire data set of the World Bank, this is about, what, five times as many observations as they had through much of their period. Now, it's true that WIDER has been adding observations, but when you add observations, you don't necessarily improve the comparability of the data. And the advantage of this is that it's a single, comprehensive, consistent data set measuring inequality. Now, what it measures, of course, is something we can argue, because it's not capturing all of income, it's just capturing the dispersion across pay in a certain segment of the income distribution, and that is a limitation. But again, I would argue that having good approximations is a very valuable step in the right direction. Here's what the data look like. When you look at their average values, and the bands give you this, the range of variation across time. And I think you will agree that these measures correspond to an intuitive understanding of the ranking of inequality across countries. That is to say, we have Scandinavia and parts of Eastern Europe in the low range, very stable. Western Europe is somewhat higher, but also very stable. The USA roughly in the middle. And to the right, range of developing countries with substantially higher inequality and much more variable over time. So at the peak, we have Peru, India, Thailand, Indonesia, Brazil, Bolivia, the Philippines, Chile, I guess, Argentina, showing up as the high end of the spectrum. That is not by any means all of the countries. There are about 150 countries in the data set, but that's a selection of them that give you a pretty good idea of how the measures of inequality compare in terms of both the levels and the degree of variation. The countries with the lowest inequality also have the most stable measures. Not a surprise, but something which I should think would reinforce your view that this is a reasonable way to go about developing a broad global data set. What does it show? You will, I'm sure, be aware that now, 60 years ago, Simon Kuznets made an argument about the relationship between inequality and income level. And the argument was that over the course of industrialization, typically the differential between rural and urban parts of society would generate a growing inequality until such time as the agricultural sector became quite small, at which point the urban picture would dominate and inequality would decline as income rose. Most of the data, to the extent that there is a clear statistical relationship between income and inequality level across countries, we find that most of the countries do in fact lie on the broad downward sloping portion of a Kuznets surface. That is to say, there is a significant downward sloping relationship. Income increases, inequality tends to be less. You could see that in the previous slide as well. A significant exception, China, for the obvious reason that China is a country where you have massive ongoing urbanization, and the gap between the rural and the urban sectors is the big driver of growing inequality in China in a period of rapid growth. And there is a further set of exceptions, just as not very many countries, but a few at the very top of the income scale. The USA is a prominent example, where it appears that as income grows, inequality increases. And why would that be the case? Again, something consistent with Kuznets, but not necessarily taken into account explicitly by him. In the US, if you have an investment boom, you're selling financial products, you're selling high technology products, you're selling them to the world. Those people are already at the top of the income spectrum. When their incomes are growing very rapidly, then inequality is going to increase. It's common sense, and it appears to be it appears to be visible in the data. Okay, so that's a first general and stylized assertion about the quality and character of the data. A second broad finding that sort of jumps out at you when you start to analyze this data, and I did this quite a few years ago, is that there are consistent patterns of change across countries within regions around the world moving through time. And what I did here to illustrate this is to just to plot the percentage change in the inequality measure from over a rolling set of 6-year periods, and to give you a scale in which it's very easily visible, pink to red to brown for declining inequality and light to dark blue for increases, so that you can just watch the map as it unfolds over time. This is not what you call sophisticated statistical analysis. This is simply exploratory data analysis giving you a sense of the information that we have and the pattern of change. In the 1960s, first of all, the coverage is not so great, but you can also see that the pattern is mixed. There's some increases and some decreases, and it's not obvious that there is a common pattern of movement. But then things begin to become interesting as you move into the 1970s. And here's the period of the oil boom in the early 1970s, 70 to 76. And what can you see? You can see, among other things, that inequality is rising in most of the depression-hit countries of Western Europe. Italy's an exception here for reasons I couldn't tell you. US, it's rising rather sharply. It's declining in the oil-producing regions from Iran through Algeria, and it's declining in parts of Latin America, which are growing rapidly on the basis of rapidly growing bank credit. When you move into the 1980s, you can see, and I'll do one more iteration here, I think this is 81 to 87, you can see the picture changes completely. And now you have rising inequality almost everywhere in the world, with the greatest proportional changes in Latin America, where we have good data, in parts of Africa, where we have some data, but indicating, I think, rather severe conditions, and in South Oceania and Southeast Asia. But we also have an interesting set of exceptions, which are here. India, China, also Iran, okay? Where inequality is not rising yet at this point. What does this suggest? It suggests to me that what is driving the movement of inequality must have a close association with the great debt crisis of the third world. And that the exception of India and China and Iran must have to do with their separation from the international system of commercial banks, commercial bank loans. India did not take commercial bank loans, China was financially autarkic, and Iran was revolutionary after 1979. So we're seeing a pattern here, which just on the basis of regional co-movement, I think tells us a great deal about what is going on in international inequality statistics. If you go on into the 1990s, we can carry this up to 1994, then you can see, again, a changing regional pattern. Now the largest increases are in former Soviet Union and its neighbors, including China. And the exception is in Southeast Asia, which up till 1997 were the Asian tigers growing very rapidly on the strength of foreign direct investment. Let me pause for a second and contrast this story, which I think emerges in a very straightforward way from an observation of patterns in the data, with the standard explanations that one hears about inequality. In the US, the literature is divided between an argument which says inequality is the result of technological change that has a skill bias in labor markets, and therefore is the result of a mismatch between the demand for skill and the supply of education. Very hard to reconcile that story with the pattern I just showed you on the global basis. There is also a story about international trade and the effect of outsourcing, which is a bit more popular with progressive economists, but it predicts that inequality would be declining in the developing regions while rising in the developed regions. And we don't observe that either. In fact, we observe that the increases in inequality in this period are most severe in the countries hit by the debt crisis, which are developing countries. So again, I suggest that a third explanation emerges from this, which is really quite straightforward. It is that the movement of inequality in structures of pay, which is what, after all, these theories are about, is substantially related to the structure of financial governance in the world economy, to the way in which finance stabilizes or destabilizes processes of economic growth. And one thing you can do to check that hypothesis, and this is the result of a statistical exercise, is to extract from the whole body of data the time pattern of common movement. So this is the result of a two-way fixed effects model, and it's basically the evolution of the time dummies in that model. The actual coefficient values are not of interest, it's their relationship to each other, which is of interest. You construct this artificial time series. And what does it show? It shows that you have a turning point, relative stability in the 60s, a turning point around 1971, a decline in many countries from 1971 to 1980, and then a massive increase, two decades of increasing inequality, peaking in 2001. Okay. What do these turning points coincide with? Well, as I've got it marked up there, they coincide with the end of the Bretton Woods currency system in 1971, with the onset of the debt crisis in 1980, and with the end of the debt crisis as interest rates were brought to zero and commodity prices began to recover in 2000. Again, a single global macroeconomic pattern appears to account for a great deal of the movement of inequality observed within countries. But what's interesting, too, is that when you take measures of inequality computed from entirely different data sources, and this is Branko Milanovic's famous concept one, which is inequality between countries computed from the Penn World Tables, you get almost exactly the same pattern. So one set of data, which is using national income accounts data, that's Branko's, an average income on that basis, gives you a decline to 1980 and then a big increase afterwards. It's the same as my within countries, between sectors, pay data. And it's also essentially the same as a measure of the profit share in the OECD. Well, she also has a turning point at the same time. And so the suggestion I would give you here is that the movement of inequality is part of a broad common force affecting the world economy and affecting international differences, the functional distribution of income, and the personal distribution of income in substantially similar ways. Very straightforward, simple line of argument, but one which seems to have a lot of support in the data. What George Soros calls the start of the super bubble appears in all three data sets. then I would just suggest that the way to think about this is that super bubble, which greatly increased the incomes at the top, also diminished them very substantially at the bottom of the world income structure. So, those are the two broad conclusions about inequality in the world economy. I want to detour a little bit and talk a little bit about US data, which has two different components. One is measurement of inequality in pay, which we can do from a wide variety of sources, mostly manufacturing, but other things can be included as well. And you can see that it depends very, very substantially on the unemployment rate. That's a month-to-month measure of inequality in manufacturing wages in the United States compared to a month-to-month measure of unemployment rates. That I don't think there's really much argument here that these two things are related. There may be other things at play, but the relationship between the two series is really apparent. And what's going on here? Something, again, I think quite straightforward. When the unemployment rate goes up, people at the bottom of the wage structure lose income. They lose hours, they lose overtime. Their weekly earnings, which is what's being measured here, recede more rapidly than those of a professor or somebody who's being paid a monthly salary. Straightforward. No story about skill bias, technological change, or education, or trade is required here. This is a very simple story about the way labor markets affect poor people more seriously than they affect people who are solidly middle class and professional. And you can see, too, that in the period in the 1990s, this inequality measure goes down quite a lot. So you go to full employment in the U.S., people at the bottom gain more rapidly than people in the middle or the top, straightforward, of the pay structure. But the income structure is a different story altogether. Income inequality in the United States, which is measured from tax data, has a component which is very heavily dominated by capital. And capital income is concentrated at the top. And here, everything I find is mirrors what Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez also find about the top 1% or 0.1% from their records of tax data. What I tend to use are data that measure inequality of incomes agglomerated into counties, which has a very nice property that you can map it and see exactly where in the country incomes are diverging, and therefore you can get a good idea for what reason. But the overall pattern is here. Income inequality measured from tax data across counties rises to a peak in what year? 2000. The more jagged series is the log of the NASDAQ stock market index. And you can see that the two series track each other almost exactly, peak at the same time, fall afterwards, proportionately by exactly the same amount. Why would that be? The most likely explanation is that they are measuring exactly the same thing. That is to say, the income potential of stock holdings in the technology sector. There's a little bump here, which is associated, I won't go into it, not enough time, with the Tax Reform Act of 1986-87. But here's the internet bubble. It bursts, income inequality goes down because stock options, realizations, capital gains, and so forth decline, right? You can track this geographically in the United States and ask how much of this income is booked in a handful of places. Here's how you do this. You take out Manhattan, one county, New York, Wall Street, and you can see that the rise of inequality is materially less. The peak is maybe 10-20% less than it would have been with Manhattan in the day. That's just one county, right? That's a handful of bankers booking their income in one place. If you take out four more counties, half of the rise of income inequality goes away. What are the other four? Three of them are Northern California: San Mateo, Santa Clara, and San Francisco, Silicon Valley. And the other one, King County, Washington, which is Seattle, which is Microsoft, which is Bill Gates. Okay. I'm very happy to be using OpenOffice this evening to give you this presentation. All right. None of your tax dollars went to support Bill Gates for this seminar. If you take out the top 15 counties, most of them also tech counties, there are a few others, then practically all of the rise in income inequality in the United States in the 1990s goes away, at least as measured between counties. It's astonishing to me. It just tells you that what's going on in that series is not just a tiny fraction of the population getting very large increases in income, it tells you exactly who they are, practically by name, since we know the names of these companies, okay? And it tells you that this is a rather powerful technique for analyzing what's going on in a country. If you look at the measure updated through 2009, a calculation just made recently by one of my research students, you can see that again, the peak is in 2000, it goes down to 2003, comes up again to the crisis, and comes down again post-crisis. It's tracking the stock market, but also real estate valuations and the value of real estate-backed securities. And if you look at where the peak in 2000 was, just mapping this out across country, across counties in the U.S., you can see, of course, the massive concentration of income in New York, but you can also see the big bumps here in Southern Florida, in Florida and in Southern California, a few other places, which actually pretty closely reflect the flow of incomes in real estate finance and construction of subdivisions at the peak of the housing boom, right? Of the largely fraudulent housing boom, which whose collapse produced the global crisis. Okay. Since we are about to have a presidential election, I'll give you one more bit of fun analysis for the United States. Question we had was, are these inequality measures related in any interesting way to political outcomes? And the answer to that is, if you measure inequality across within states in the United States, it's not obvious. Some of the high inequality states are Republican, some of them are Democrat. But it struck me just looking at the maps that there was a distinction between the states that tended to vote Republican and the states that tended to vote Democratic. And that distinction was that some states, the incomes are highly stratified across counties, and in other states they are not. That is, some states have basically counties where the rich and the poor live close to each other, and in others they are separated, polarized geographically. And a vector of a measure of that stratification does a pretty good job of explaining why it is that some of the richer states vote Democratic, while richer people almost always have a tendency to vote Republican. It's called the Gelman paradox. Well, do this measure, and what do you find? In 2000, I think it's the 12 most polarized states, 11 of them voted for Gore. Only one clearly voted for Bush. Florida was stolen. Of the 12 least polarized states, only one voted for Gore. So at the extremes of the political distribution, this seems to do a pretty good predictive job of who's going to be going for the Democrats and who for the Republicans. In 2008, whoops, let's go back. In 2008, of the 12 most, 11 voted for Obama. Of the 12 least polarized, 9 voted for McCain. And looking at last year's data and projecting forward, again, the pattern appears to be pretty clear. 11 of the 12 are pretty clearly Obama, unless there's a real disaster and he falls apart in tonight's debate. Florida is uncertain, so 10 of the 12. Arizona is likely to be Romney. And of the most least polarized states, practically all of them will be for Romney, except Vermont and Maine. So, again, we'll see how long that prediction lasts, but it tells you that this kind of measurement has information content that's useful for a large, a number of different kinds of fields. Let's see, how much time do I have? I'm going to take another 10 minutes or so and talk about the application of these ideas to a problem that is particularly of interest and importance to Europe and to the application of economic thought to in particular the problem of European unemployment. You have probably heard from the high priests of the economic profession the idea that European unemployment is due to the deep rigidity of your labor markets, and that the solution to European unemployment is, shall we say it all in three-part harmony, flexibilization. Right? Reducing barriers, making it possible for employers to pay people according to their skills, to fire them at will, etc., etc., etc. With, of course, the great example being the high employment in the United States due to our marvelously flexible labor market. Thank you very much. We'll take your congratulations as I leave the room. Yeah. All right. This is the view of the OECD in its infamous job study, 1994. And the ideas here are very straightforward. First of all, there's something called a labor market. And it's a labor market is a national phenomenon, which is to say the characteristics of the labor market are countries. Countries have different institutions. Some are flexible, some are rigid. Okay? So national institutions matter. Flexibility reduces unemployment for the reason I just gave. And the American model, more jobs but more inequality. So, what's the implication? You have a choice. You can either have your job protections or you can have jobs, but you can't have both. And that's been the message economists have been delivering relentlessly to Europeans for a long time before the crisis. Right? There is also a different view, which is called the variety of capitalism's view in some literature before the crisis, which also says that employment is determined in a labor market, that labor markets are national, national institutions matter, but says, well, there are different models in different countries, and in particular, there's something called the Scandinavian model, which has this peculiar property, it's very egalitarian, but works pretty well, has low unemployment. Why would this be the case, though? There's no explanation, except that the Scandinavians are Scandinavian. I once asked, I was at a lunch where I had the privilege of asking a question to Monsieur Trichet, and I asked him what he made of Scandinavia. He said they're very different. What kind of a scientific response is that? Well, they're tall, they're blonde. Does that help? I don't know. Any event. So here's the two problems. As I said, the job study cannot explain Scandinavia. And in one analysis, Professor Heckman just added all of the active labor market participant employments, employed participants to the unemployed in order to make the Scandinavians look worse than they were. And the other is that you can't, the deficient problem of the new pluralist view is that it's essentially sterile from a policy point of view. So, can we do better? In particular, can we develop a kind of unified theory of unemployment that is consistent with the facts? I think there are two models which are actually well developed in various literatures that are not particularly dissident or heterodox that we can bring to bear. One of them comes from the development literature, and it's a model that was advanced by Harris and Todaro to explain unemployment in East Africa in the 1960s. And the idea was that if you have a city with a high minimum wage, people are going to be attracted to that from the countryside. There are going to be more of them looking for jobs than there are jobs available, and guess what? In the meantime, they'll be unemployed. Right? So that inequality in this, because of search and migration, actually increases unemployment systematically. And if you think about that, in the modern world, I suggest you immediately turn your mind to China and ask, what are the consequences of having a vast income differential between the cities and the countryside? A clear, visible consequence that you can see in any train station in China is hundreds of millions of people moving to get jobs in the cities, of which only a certain fraction will be employed at any given time, and the rest unemployed. May not be counted, but they're there, they're visible, you can find them, and any Chinese economist will tell you that that's the case. That is a fact arising from the rise in inequality. Before you had the rise in inequality, people didn't move to the cities in China because there wasn't any advantage to it. Right? And you go back 30 years, you find the high income in China is actually mining in the Gobi Desert. Small number of people, probably mining uranium, but in any event. The other model is the Scandinavian model itself, which actually has been more or less forgotten, but the great work of Wren and Meidner in the 40s and 50s, who held that if you compressed your pay structures and did certain other things, including active labor market policies, you would gradually push out your weak firms and attract strong ones and raise the average productivity level and the competitiveness of your economy so that you could have a highly competitive economy on an egalitarian footing with an open posture toward trade. That's Scandinavia. And I suggest that Wren Meidner actually accounts for the rise of Swedish and Nordic living standards generally from average for Europe in the 30s to the top of the world scale in the 1990s and 2000s. And they did that because it became a place where the most efficient industries could grow and the least efficient ones would not survive. And therefore, you had an averaging, an increase in the relative position of those countries in the world scale. And then, of course, with the resources, you can keep people in the services sector or absorb them in government or wherever you want. Okay. What can we do? We need a good data set. Can we get one out of the literature on labor market institutions? The answer is no. A traditional literature that has dealt with this has data on things like union coverage and degree of centralization. And the data sets look like this. A scale of 1 to 3. And what do we see about union coverage in Europe in the 60s to the 90s? They're all threes except for maybe 4 or half a dozen observations. This is violating the principle that you need variation in the X's. Very weak source of econometric evidence. Can you do any better than that? The answer is, well, yes, you can. And what we dug into was the regional panel data set from Regio and Eurostat, which gives us pay across sectors by nuts level economic regions, up to 159 regions, 17 years. And we can compute inequality within and between regions and construct a panel with a very nice properties that you can separate out the effects at the regional level, the national level, and the continental level. Tiles t-statistic, I've already given that, so I won't do that. Here's the model. There's two factors of demand. Unemployment will depend upon growth. The relative wealth of the region in the European setting. And two supply factors. The share of population that's young, because young populations have a transition to work problem, and the inequality of pay. And the key prediction is that the inequality of pay will have a positive effect on unemployment. The more unequal, the more unemployment, not the less. Direct contradiction, theoretically based contradiction, to the standard story. And then you can do country and time fixed effects, so you do a two-way fixed effect model. Here's the regressions. What do you find? You find that at the total population, the male population, female, less than 25, greater than 25 years broken out separately, the inequality effects are all of the right sign. They are significant in three or four or five different population settings, and all the other variables are significant and of the right sign, except maybe one or two of them. A very good degree of explanation, particularly when you include the two-way fixed effects. You get about 61% of the unemployment across regions explained in the model. A lot of the explanatory power is, in fact, country differences. And the country differences are very interesting because they are largely rooted in deviations of prediction for some small countries, of which the differences are not important for the large ones. Scandinavia is not an exception here. Scandinavia has low unemployment simply because it has low inequality and a high degree of wealth, but it's perfectly within the parameters of the model. The exceptions are Portugal, which I would point to as a case where a large part of when a high unemployment, the unemployed labor force goes outside the country and is no longer counted. What's the largest Portuguese city after Lisbon? Paris. And then these two other countries, Ireland and Austria, which have the interesting property, their unemployment is much lower than would be predicted by the model. But they, so there is a national labor market institution there, but what is it? These are the two great cases of completely centralized wage bargaining in Europe, right? And when you look at the Austrian case compared to Germany, you find the following. The Austrians keep their traded goods wages at a 10-12% discount to Germany, attracting manufacturing, and allow the wages and everything else to be higher than the Germans, living off the proceeds. Very nice. But you can only do that with a very inflexible, not a flexible labor market. So the evidence strongly opposes the notion that there is a labor market flexibility. It suggests, in fact, labor market inflexibility administered in an intelligent way can help a small country reduce its unemployment. And the Irish did the same thing to the British. And then you look at the time fixed effects and you find that there is a pattern of continental covariation, which inequality rises in the 1990s after Maastricht and falls in the first phase of the euro as the credit conditions improve across the European periphery. And you can be sure, of course, that we extend this analysis, it will go up massively with the crisis at the European level. So, I'll pass over the additional research results. You can do a lot of additional kinds of work with this, but it does suggest to me that while I would not place inequality as a variable which we need to be, we should put on a pedestal and treat as the most important economic or social variable, it's an extraordinarily interesting thing to measure because it enables us to make consistent comparisons in a way that we couldn't do before, and it enables us to usefully confront a body of policy prescriptions which are rooted in ideology, in a dogmatic application of theory, and an extremely weak body of evidence. Extremely weak, and in some cases, I think, fanciful, forced would be a nice word, body of evidence. A body of evidence which has been stretched and pummeled so as to give the previously desired result. And you don't have to do that with the inequality measures. You can allow the data to speak to you and ask the question, what is it that it is actually trying to show? And I think in many cases you get an answer which is relatively easy to interpret. And it tells you, broadly speaking, that inequality is driven by financial forces and by macroeconomic performance, and that it's extremely useful to try and bring these two fields together, which I think for economists poses a very interesting challenge, because traditionally, and from the standpoint of the structure of our discipline, macroeconomics is one thing, and inequality has been a topic that is a microtopic, something that emerges from the determination of relative prices in separated and segmented markets, the interaction of supply and demand. And if it turns out that that is arguments refuted by the data, but that inequality is a phenomenon with a broad pattern of common movement around the globe, strongly related to macro policy instruments such as the governance of finance, then we both have policy implications to draw from that, but also very strong theoretical implications about the need to rethink the independence of microeconomic phenomena from macro determination. And this old business about micro foundations of macroeconomics can be inverted, and we can ask ourselves, isn't it what we really need to have a proper macro foundations, a macro foundation for understanding what are our microeconomic outcomes? Well, thanks very much.
presentation, I think the most effective way would be to organize the questions on small contributions along first the analysis of inequality, the measurement, the data, and then about the implications and the determinants, the link with unemployment, the links with the crisis.